I have to admit, I don't want to be
Debbie Downer?
Downer guy. But Darren, I'm kind of waiting for the electricity of the Stanley Cup playoffs to hit me. I don't know why.
Well, I can tell you why. I think that the Winnipeg game was what we anticipated the Winnipeg game to be against St. Louis. Ebbs and flows, you know, some challenges for Connor Hellebuck early. The team readjusted. A late winning goal, fantastic. And, you know, the whiteout was as advertised. And as you know, I love the National Hockey League. I love the Stanley Cup playoffs. Everything else is pretty flat. It's pretty flat. The games haven't had, and I think there's a normalcy to this. It's been a long season. There hasn't been that much of a break in resetting, but we're still trying to find a way to create some levels of rivalry, even in these series with teams that are familiar with each other. It's just not there yet. It will come. It usually comes by game three of each series. But there hasn't been as much gripping hockey as I expected. I was really anticipating a great playoff. I'm still waiting for that to occur.
A lot of goals have been scored, though. Maybe too many, because there's we're not getting those goals. Overtime.
There's never
games.
Too many goals. Goals are great. Let's face it, goals are great. But you know, teams are. Some teams are playing cautious. Some teams are playing conservative, and I think there's a difference. You look at the way Vegas, like last night. Did you ever feel the Golden Knights were in trouble, ever?
You know, driving home from the game, I said they were never up by more than two, and the game was never in doubt.
Correct. Exactly right. You know, and one of the things that we have witnessed in, you know, the 1,312 games of the regular season is that the three-goal lead isn't even safe. Well, you know what? We're going to find that a little more now that, you know, big leads might be safe. Two-goal leads might be safe, the way people can lock the game down. Goaltenders can elevate their game. It's going to be great still. It's just not as highly anticipated. It hasn't reached my expectation yet. Monday night might reach it when you have four games and they're overlapping and we're buzzing between games.
Traditional schedule.
A more traditional schedule, yep. But it will be fun to watch. I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing how Washington and Montreal manage it. I'm looking forward to seeing what happens in Los Angeles with Edmonton.
And at some point, Florida and Tampa will join the Stanley Cup
playoffs. Well, I think they're going to start Saturday.
Yeah. Now, will the Stanley Cup final have to wait for Florida and Tampa Bay to finish before the final gets underway?
We do not. Listen, we just had the schedule maker on. Do not get the schedule maker mad at us. You know, we don't want phone calls.
Well, I'm just blaming it on building availability.
And I checked it. The building was wide open.
Really?
Wide open.
Just assume. We'll see if Mike Johnson has any information.
Well, here's an aside. The Edmonton game could have played last night. But the Kings don't like to play Sunday night games. So they actually tried to push it to Tuesday too, but they said no, we'll go Monday. So,
how long have you known Mike Johnson?
I met Mike. I was executive producer when Mike played for the Leafs. So I think I met Mike that first Saturday that he played.
Really?
That's the first time I met Mike. Yeah.
Boy, the guy was skilled. He had great hands. Great hands. And what I enjoy most about Mike is his confidence. He will say what he wants to say.
And I got to work with Mike during the Olympic Winter Games in Beijing in 2022, and we had a blast. We had a great time, and that's the first time I'd ever really worked with him. We have mutual friends, obviously.
He did a trade deadline with us one year, but you were over on the newsbreaker desk.
Yeah, nobody was talking to me by then. So, But I got to do the whole Olympic run with he and Chris Cuthbert were our number one crew, and we had a blast. We had a really good time.
You've never hired me. You talk about all these people that you've hired. You've never hired me.
What are you talking about? You were in Vegas.
But you never hired me.
You know who you sound like when you do that? You know who you sound like?
Who?
Bob McCowan. Because he would always lament, you never hired me. I said, oh, I couldn't, you were a pain in the ass. I couldn't stand where, I wouldn't want to work with you.
Well, at least you didn't say that about me. Oh, look it, there's Mike Johnson. He's here. saved by the light. Former player.
My light is burned out.
Long time broadcaster. Oh, you've been told that before. I know that. MJ's times. Coming up on 100% Hockey with Millard and Shannon. Get deeper into it. Here's Mike Johnson from the NHL Network. TSN does everything around the National Hockey League with Millard and Shannon. Where are you right now?
I'm in Toronto. Okay. I'm in my office in Toronto. We worked last night in the TSN studio, do some radio stuff, heading down to the NHL Network in a couple of days. But yeah, no, we're still in Toronto, which had a big collective exhale after last night because it was the rarest of occasions. A stress-free playoff game for the Toronto Maple Leafs. They haven't felt that in a decade.
The Battle of Ontario, and it wasn't much of a battle as Ottawa, they looked like a team that was getting its first taste, didn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think when you haven't played in the playoffs, but you've been in the league for a while, which a lot of Ottawa top players have, right? Like Chabot and Batherson, Kachuk, Stutzla. And you hear over and over how different it is, how physical it is, how intense it is. You almost feel like you need to prove that we're capable of playing that, what you perceive to be different style of hockey. And it felt like Ottawa got themselves a little bit out of sorts trying to prove with good intentions that they can be this physical, intense team. I think next game, if they just play, you play hard, but just play the way you normally do, it'll be a truer test of what that series will look like.
Well, do you think the 6-2 was truly indicative of the style of the game?
Well, special teams are part of the game, right, John? So, like, not 5-on-5, no, right? Like, 5-on-5, it was pretty even. Ottawa would tell you that they had more chances, more expected goals, more zone time. All true. Some of that is score effects coming into play as they were trailing and chasing. But power play is part of the game. The Leafs will tell you they got one power play goal last year, the entire series. It cost them the series. Yeah. So they got three in game one.
No, they got part of the game. Mike, they got three in 20 seconds. They got three in 20 seconds.
We don't worry about zone entries. We just take the puck off a faceoff and take it. That's like little kid hockey. You win a faceoff, you go to the net. It's like immediately, yes, 3-on-20. High efficiency. Mark Savard would appreciate that, the power play coach in Toronto. But, I think the other part of the story is that the goalie for Toronto was better than the goalie for Ottawa by a considerable margin. And if that's the case in any series, let alone that one, then the team with the better goalie is generally going to win.
You talked about the exhale. Does that mean your expectations of that Toronto team are that much higher than years past? Not just to win a round, but to go deeper?
Yeah,
or is it just the opponent and Ottawa and the rivalry?
Well, I mean, I think the exhale last night was that I think Toronto fans are so scared that it's going to go poorly because it generally has that they prepare for the worst. And so when it doesn't, they feel good. But I think Toronto is well positioned to go deeper, not just around, and it's funny to say this for a team that's had so much failure, but they're well positioned to go deep to the finals deep in that. They've never had first in the division, other than that Canadian division year, which was a strange one. So they don't play maybe the toughest teams in the first round. I think that's fair to say. Then I think the Metro division is not as strong this year. It's probably the weakest division in the league. So if you get to the conference final, you're not playing, Winnipeg, Dallas, Colorado, Vegas would probably all be the favorite in the Eastern Conference. Mm-hmm. They're not in that conference. They're in the softer conference. They have a great track record and home ice against Tampa. If they get there in the second round, Florida, you don't know. So yes, you're putting the cart before the horse a little bit, but I think Toronto should feel bullish about their opportunities. Now they could easily lose the first round easily, but they could also easily get to the cup final, not easily, but they could also get to the cup final.
You beat me to it because the Leaf fans are happy until game two. Mm-hmm. Because yeah. You do know that that Ottawa is going to play better.
Yeah.
In the second game, they're going to adjust. There was tons of talk. I didn't really understand it much, but maybe you can explain it. Tons of talk that maybe the Senators were better 5-on-5. I don't necessarily buy that. But Travis Green understands what it's going to take. I mean, you've done enough Senators games, enough Leaf games to know both of these coaches well enough that the adjustments will for game two are going to happen on both sides, right?
100%. And now I think Ottawa would cling to the fact that they weren't, it was an even game at 5-on-5. I don't think Ottawa was dominant, but it was pretty even. And I think that's how they want to play this series. They're not significantly worse than the Toronto Maple Leafs. Game two will tell you everything. If Toronto wins again and their best players score again and they score more than two goals, which again, they haven't done, right? 13 of the last 14 games prior to last night, two or fewer in the playoffs. If they score again and go up 2-0, it will feel really different. And Toronto will really feel comfortable and confident in that series. If they lose, whatever the game looks like, all that scar tissue. Part of the dynamic of this series was that Ottawa was going to try to apply pressure internally or externally on the Leafs by extending it, casting doubt, bringing up the past failures. And if they can win game two, all that will be true. Because Toronto also has generally not been very good at home in the playoffs. And they looked pretty good last night. So, yeah, we'll know way more after game two. I think Ottawa will just be more comfortable going into that game, given that they've been through one now. And we'll see a truer test of what this series will look like.
I mentioned on the podcast before that I've talked to players who have gone through Toronto and this year and said they're a different team than years past. They just play harder. There's a different style. And those two power play goals right in front of the net, like that, that gives a Maple Leaf fan confidence that you can score without the breakaways, which they also did. But there's a grindier, greasier component to their game.
Yeah, so I think, he's not the most important player, but Matthew Nyes and what he has become has been a really significant growth and change in the Toronto Maple Leafs in that he's not better than those other guys, but he's different than those other big fours. He's like, he plays a different style. He's physically more imposing in what he does well. And when they went to that five forward power play unit, it was either him or Riley. That was basically the guy that was coming in. And Morgan Riley would come in and Nyes would go off, or Nyes would go in and Riley would come off, and they stuck with it. And he's made a difference. He does things that those other guys don't do. He goes to the front of that and he can score goals. Darren, you know it well, watching Vegas, they score a ton of goals banging around the front of that because they're bigger and stronger. Matthew Nyes is bigger and stronger than just about anybody in the league. He's a monster there. So yeah, that is different. He is a bit of a wild card difference maker this year that wasn't maybe there last year. So, and then listen, they defend stoutly. They play on their own end more this year than years past. Toronto does, but they defend the front of their net stoutly. And I think Carlo has come in and made Morgan Riley much better. I think you put Jake McCabe with Chris Tanev and they are really good defensive pairing. And then your third pair is big guys who've been there before, and Ekman Larson and an energetic Benoit. So they make it tougher to get to the front of the net, which might be different than years past.
The Tanev equation is a big factor in this, though, isn't he? I mean, he makes such a difference defensively.
And it's a funny, John, when you watch him play, like, so Chris is such an old school guy. Like, he's got no time to talk to us. You don't want any fluffy questions. Like, he's got his teeth out and his hair slicked back. And he eats pucks for fun. But he is, in today's offensive game, and NHL is all about offense now and skill, he is a true defensive defenseman. Like, he doesn't barely ever score. And yet when you watch him play, and as an analyst, I'm down between the benches doing Leaf games, or as a former player, how smart he is at on a forecheck. He absorbs the pressure, doesn't skate away from it because he's not a brilliant skater. He's just a functional skater. Absorbs the pressure, spins, takes another hit, and then pops a puck to someone who could do something with it. The ability to give the puck to a teammate who can then do something positive with it is an absolutely underrated and necessary skill in your own end. And he does it as well as anyone, especially for a guy who never puts up points. He's so good at getting the puck out of his own end and then, you know, blocking and defending when he doesn't have it. But I think the underrated part of his game, John, is that when he gets it out effectively.
Right.
And I think that really separates him from maybe other physical guys who get it out off the glass, but then it comes back right back to them. He gets it out on the tape and then they can go attack.
By the way, did you see the ice time of the six guys?
They were identical.
I know.
They're like 1804 to 1838. Like, yeah,
the,
within like
the low guy, the low guy was Ekman Larson at 1712. The high guy was Jake McCabe at 1936. They were
you
all,
never see that.
Never.
Never see that in the NHL. And they have guys that can play 25 minutes. And that's brilliant for Ekman Larson, who's coming off an injury, and McCabe, that you can lighten their load in a game one that way. That was, yeah, I did see that. It was very unusual.
A lot to love about Toronto, but I'm as excited as any series to see how Ottawa reacts. Like, I think that there's a real positive possibility here for the Senators.
You should. I mean, Ottawa, underrated part about their year, they were sort of a top eight defensive team in the league. Like, all their underlying metrics, like, they were good defensively. And they didn't have their best game. Special teams, they lost the battle badly. But they'll push Toronto. This is not going to be an easy series. Yeah. You know, they had, if you think about the second period of game one, 2-1 Toronto. Tkachuk had a breakaway.
Right.
Looking pretty fast, taking off on Morgan Riley. Looked pretty quick. Shane Pinto had a seam pass, Royal Road, clean handle, one-on-one. Stolarz comes across. And then Zetterlund had a backdoor, wide-open net that caught goalie smiling in Jumillard. Lucky knob off the tape for Stolarz. With a wide-open net, just hit the knob of his stick. All three of those goals would have made it 2-2. It would have been a different game, and then the Leafs scored a power play goal, and then everything else happened. So, yes, the score makes Toronto feel good and Ottawa feel like they weren't quite in it. That probably wasn't the case, and it won't be the case. This is going to be a tough series for Toronto to get through. Toronto will be really well served to play well and be ready for a tighter game in game two than they saw in game one.
You ever play with Travis Green?
I did in Arizona. Mm. In Arizona, we briefly crossed paths. And Trav is well documented as a player to be fun-loving, hilarious in the room, prankster, disturber, like always stirring it up, always in the thick of everything, in the card game, at the dinner. He was in the middle of all of it. And like such a gravitational personality. Everybody wanted to be part of Trav's little orbit. And then I saw him walk into when he was in Vancouver after he coached in the WHL. And I'm like, Trav, what happened to you? You look like such a coach. Like, you're so, your dour demeanor and you're always so straight faced. And he's like, I still got it. Let's go for dinner. And he does. he's still the same guy, but he knows, well, one, he's a very good coach. Like, he's a bright guy who understands the dynamic of how to push players, not just X's and O's, which I think most coaches in the NHL are generally pretty proficient X's and O's. And the assistants do a lot of that. But he understands people, understands how to relate to them, how to talk to them, how to talk to Darren Millard, who is, you know, tough and rugged and doesn't need what Mike Johnson, who's soft and sensitive, needs. Like, he understands how each player and each person needs something different. And yeah, and he won't, like, I think right away in the post-game presser, John, last night, he right away went sort of suggesting the Leafs embellished on some of their penalties, which I don't think is true at all. Like, Tanev got hit from behind. Austin Matthews got cross-checked from behind and fell over. John Tavares got stick at the side of his head. Like, I don't think anyone sold those calls, but he was just sort of laying the groundwork. He answered the Goldie question very definitively, almost dismissively, about Omark's not a bad guy. We like him quite a bit. He's one of the best, and he's pretty good. And also talk about the 5-on-5 play. So I think he was laying the groundwork to try to build his team up after what would have been a disappointing night.
Because I, in watching him behind the bench, I loved his demeanor. A lot of coaches would have blown a gasket, a bigger gasket than he did last night. I just loved his demeanor behind the bench through all of that stuff, through thick and thin, through the penalties, through some stupid plays by his own team.
And he got there, initially, like he was sort of like, and he was after the ref, especially on the Stutzla penalty. And then eventually, like, if you as a coach get a bit out of control, then it almost gives your team license to get more out of control.
Right. Right.
Right. And you feed off his sort of manic energy. He's yelling at the ref. We're yelling at the ref.
Right.
He's saying it's the ref's fault. Then the game we're losing is the ref's fault. And he takes the sort of onus away from the players to corral themselves and take responsibility for what's going on there. You're right. I thought he reined it back in instead of taking it further when the game got to, I guess, 4-1.
Right.
You ever play for a coach that gave it to the refs where you felt like you could piggyback, where you could felt you could jump on board?
How long do we have?
Hey, it's a podcast. We can go forever. Yeah. There's no rules.
I mean, I had Pat Quinn, who was not loud, but he was relentless. Like you're bitching and moaning at the refs the whole game.
And your group was really active on the bench,
we were
the referees.
Chirpy. We followed in on that, yes. We had Ludzik and Tortorella in Tampa with an immature group who took a lot of penalties.
Yeah.
So that didn't help because we were like, you know, they were yelling at the ref. We'd be yelling at the ref and out of control. And even Gretz, who I had in Arizona, who I was amazed because Wayne Gretzky is going to have a camera on him the entire game, right? An ISO camera on Gretzky. John, you'd be producing the game. Mm-hmm. ISO camera on Gretz the entire game. And he didn't care. If he saw something he didn't like, he'd be like, what the? You know, he'd be all, and like, you know, now it was, we didn't quite follow in line with him as much because he can do whatever he wants. We're not the same as him. But yeah, it's true. Guys take their cues from their coach in that way.
Well, I don't know. During the Ovechkin episodes this year going for 895, didn't you hear Wayne at one point say, I was more like John McEnroe?
Yeah, listen, he was fiery. I remember, you know, and he picked his spots, but I remember one time we were playing Anaheim in an exhibition game and something happened. He wasn't happy. He was like screaming at or yelling at somebody on Anaheim's team. And Teemu Selänne and him got, and Teemu's like, mind your own business, worry about your own bench. And him and Teemu, who are buddies from California, they're going at each other. And I think as a new player, I'm like, I liked it. I liked that my coach was no longer Wayne Gretzky, polished ambassador of the world. He was fiery coach invested in what's going on because that's how he was at a rink. He was always fiery and invested in what's going on when he was part of a team.
I want to get back to Anaheim and what happened there from a player's perspective in just a little bit. But Winnipeg wins, and you talked about exhale with the Toronto side of it. I could feel it from Manitoba as well because they trailed so much in that game. They deserve the win, but I just wonder what that does for them. In years past, they've won that first game and haven't been able to follow it up. Does the series really start now?
No, I mean, I think when I was watching Darren, you could tell me, given the way Hellebuck's year went in the playoffs last year, after a Vezina caliber season, when I saw was Robert Thomas got the first one, I'm like,
it's a great shot.
Shots Robert, in the corners.
That's
can be
Robert
stopped.
Thomas's. That's his perfect spot on the ice. He scored 30 like that this year, right from there.
It's wild, John, except he doesn't shoot. He's like the new Ryan Getzlaf. Wicked shot, just doesn't want to take it.
Yeah.
Like, if he ever just decided to shoot, he might score 45. But anyways, I was watching, and because Hellebuck set the standards so high, of course we're going to watch, does he follow it up with another really good performance? And I was like, I don't know. They're losing, and he didn't look great, and I don't know. And the fact that the team sort of dominated the second half of the game, and in some ways, not bailed out, but won it without great goaltending.
Yeah.
Fair to say that way. I think that helps them going into game two, where, you know, Hellebuck doesn't have to feel like he's got carry the weight of the world on his shoulders because the team is good enough to do it with just him being solid. And I think the idea that Mark Scheifele and Kyle Connor were so good in that game, outrageously good. Kyle Connor might have the quietest, what do you have, 97 points this year?
Yeah.
And like no one talks about him as an elite, like top
particularly on the team, particularly on the Team USA coaching staff. So,
well, you got to sit him down and make sure you got extra guys on the ice to play 2 minutes. Absolutely. But I think like some good things happened there, and the fact they won the game makes it better for them for game two. I think if I'm St. Louis, I'm almost concerned that Winnipeg will be better than they were in game one. So we'll see. And I will say 5-on-5, like almost since I've retired, the idea of running faceoff plays is something that has grown tremendously.
Yeah.
Tremendous. Every team, every line, every team has like 6 or 8 variations that they like to run. Some are very, like very normal, walk the middle, drop it to the side. But that one, the round the world wheel, which McDavid likes to run in Edmonton, they tried it a couple times, worked the second time. I love to see it, especially 5-on-5, because 5-on-4, 5-on-3, absolutely set plays, you have time. But 5-on-5, with everything happening, to get all 5 guys on the same page off a set play makes the sort of hockey nerd in me smile. I'm like, well done. Well done by Winnipeg for a game-winning goal the last couple of minutes too. Very timely, but well done.
It was the most obviously executed face-off play I've ever seen.
Well, not to Braden Schenn.
No.
they've been Winnipeg's been trying to run it all year.
Yeah, no, it's nothing new. You're right. You know what it was? Darren, it was so cleanly executed. Yes. So like, yeah, if you were to draw that up on the whiteboard and execute that face off in practice without any defenders, like 5-on-0, it would have looked exactly like that. You couldn't have done it any tidier for the one timer. If you tried with 0 players on the ice going against you, they just did it against 5 guys, but it was really Braden Schenn who sort of got stuck staring at a puck and kind of dropped in the lane too deep and didn't find that Kyle Connor gap. But you're right. It was easy to understand what was happening for people who maybe can't see all 10 pieces moving at the same time.
Can we put the defenders in practice with their sticks upside down like you used to do?
Only when you want the power play to score goals and feel good about themselves. But as a guy who got to kill penalties too, so sometimes I would be on the penalty kill practice, when you would kill penalties with your sticks upside down, you would be celebrating and the power play guys would get so mad. They would start shooting pucks at ankles. Get so pissed off because you'd be rubbing it in like, I don't even have a stick. You can't get past me.
We'll take a break. We'll come back with more Mike Johnson on 100% Hockey with Millard and Shannon. Dallas loses every playoff series opener. So
not like this.
There shouldn't be that much.
Not like this.
You're concerned, John?
Oh, I'm really concerned. I am. And I'm concerned because when I looked at the lineup, I looked at their blue line and said, boy, oh boy, there's not much there. That's a problem. Mm-hmm. And I think Colorado exploited it. Don't you, Mike?
The right side was always going to be thin, right? You love Haskin and you love Lundell, but you know, if you're looking at Labushkin and you're looking at Dumba, you know, they played Petrovic in the game, like they were thin. And they, now every team loses a Haskinen, it's going to be a huge blow. But as deep as they are up front, they were not that deep on the back end. Like Haskinen has to lard huge minutes. Haskinen, Harley, Lundell have to be amazing and play a lot and carry their partners. And you take one of those guys out, the best one of them was going to play, he would play 30 minutes and he would play McKinnon. Mm-hmm. Haskinen is one of the few players in the world who could conceivably skate with McKinnon.
Right.
Gap up. Handle him off the rush. Don't retreat. Don't concede space. And he's out of the lineup. And it was a problem. Yes. I guess they tell themselves we do this all the time. Concerns for me for Dallas. Defense, as John just mentioned. I think everyone's a fan of Jake Oettinger and how good he looks when he's good. He wasn't great down the stretch. And he's had some, you know, not great moments in the playoffs. He's also had some crazy good moments in the playoffs. But like, there's been fluctuations in his game. He hasn't given you that steady A game. Sometimes A plus plus, sometimes a B minus or a C. And if he's not going to be an A against Colorado, this Colorado team, how different they are, that's going to be a problem. I mean, you lose your best forward in Robertson, you lose your best defenseman in Haskinen. Already going in, the two best positional players were going to play for Colorado, which they'll probably say in every series, like they got McKinnon and McCarr, who will be the two best skaters in every series they go against. It's a really tough challenge. And the underrated, I guess, identification and acquisition of Mackenzie Blackwood, because you'd have to be like Blackwood in Jersey had good moments and not good moments. Blackwood's numbers, the top line numbers were no good in San Jose because nobody's are good in San Jose, right? Wins were terrible, goals against, save percentage. His underlyings, if you're an analytical guy and goalies, they were very strong. And Colorado made that read, made that trade, signed him. He was really good as well. He made some timely saves when the game was in balance. So we'll see. We'll see. But it's tough. It's tough because Colorado is so good. And Gabe Landeskog might play game two if Ross Colton can't go because he might be nicked up. We'll see what Gabe Landeskog can bring. I think we're all sort of like, I just hope he can get there and have a positive experience. I don't know if his body's quite ready, but Colorado has revamped their whole team for a good team this year. And they look pretty good in game one doing it.
You know, one of the problems of doing a podcast is, first of all, in this playoff year, we've probably done, like, I feel like we've done five playoff previews because the games are so spread out.
I've never seen this before.
I've never seen this
before. I didn't know this. So I just talked to Bill Daly, like, literally within the hour, name drop. And he told me that the league consciously has expanded the first round window to more days. So there aren't so many four-game nights in the first round only.
Right.
So they can have a chance to stagger two-game nights, three-game nights, and take the first round to 18 days instead of 14 just to spread. I didn't know that was like an official thing.
For TV, it's all done for television.
I didn't know that either, Johnny.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I didn't know that. Now, in the second round, you don't need it because there's only four series, early, late, early, late. But in the first round.
To go from Saturday to Tuesday for the start of the playoffs to meet is hard. Particularly those old dogs like us that are used to having the Western Conference on odd days and the Eastern Conference on even days.
Well, and you love the four game nights because it's just a flurry of action that overwhelms you. And I didn't feel like that this weekend.
I guess my point about this is that we could preview every game on the Monday, but by the time people listen to this, you know, the game will already have occurred. But the Tampa Florida game won't.
Yeah. Well, you have teams approaching their third game. They'll be getting ready for their first. But
that's right.
If you're a Florida fan and you have guys that are still working through stuff, even an extra week for Matthew Tkachuk or Barkov or Reinhardt or Verhaeghe or Bennett, all Forsling, all these guys who are taking breaks, you give an athlete, like, we're not used to 36 hours off. Right, like maybe we get a day and that's all we ever sort of get. Your body never really gets more than a day in a season. You give us like 5 days with the technology we have at our disposal and, you know, the shape the players are in, you get a lot better when you don't do anything for 5 days. Nobody touches you for 5 days. So Tampa probably would have been happy to start on Sunday, but not have to wait the extra 3 days for Florida to get, if they're going to get, a little bit healthier.
Right, and this is in terms of what you were talking about, how the Leafs road to the final might be easy. And the only team, I think the only two teams that have a more difficult road right now are Tampa and Florida, just because of this first round series. When you look at the level of difficulty in the Eastern Conference versus the West, correct?
Yeah, I mean, if you're in the East, the Atlantic, the 2-3 matchup in the Atlantic is the toughest place to be. Sure. And I guess the worst place to be is the three seed, right? Florida on the road. And Tampa has had Florida's number, if I'm not mistaken, for much of this year. And, you know, they played them a couple of games late and they got them. They got the job done. I think Vasilevsky has reemerged as a Vezina finalist. We all know he's going to win, but he's going to be a finalist. And I think the hope of the rest of the Eastern Conference is this is like a hellacious series, vicious series. They want guys walking off with like ankles hanging by a thread to make these two teams, which Toronto won the division. If you were to poll everyone, I don't even know about the gambling books, like Florida and Tampa are probably the two favorites to come out of the Eastern Conference, even though they're not the first seed. So yeah, I mean, I think that's a really tough first round matchup for both those teams. Both are Stanley Cup capable and both one will be going home in 17 days.
But Carolina was impressive. Like, they just swarmed New Jersey.
Is that Carolina or Jersey, Darren? Because Darren,
I thought New Jersey was horrendous.
Yes,
they were awful.
And the
Carolina—that's a tough building.
They couldn't even get a shot on goal in the first two periods.
Now, like, so Carolina does this to teams, right? Like, Carolina maybe more than anyone. They always outshoot teams by a ton. They don't give up much. They take a ton. The shot clock always looks miserable. Even when you're playing a decent game, it's always, oh, it's 37-24. It's always that way. Stylistically, that's what they do. But as far as the pressure, Carolina's largely played the same way under Brindamore for like a half a decade. This is not surprising. This is what they do. So the fact that Jersey looks so unsettled by what was a predictable game plan would be troubling. And I get it. Like, Jack Hughes is missing him is a big problem. You know, Brendan Dillon played only a few minutes. They had other guys getting banged around, but that was surprising. I thought Jersey would have showed better. Not that Carolina wouldn't win. I thought Jersey would show better. 38-13 after two periods, the shots. Yes. And that was sort of reflective of the game. It was like an 80-20 game in favor of Carolina. Markstrom wasn't really good. That would have been 7-1 after two periods and long over. So Jersey will cling to the fact that we can't be that bad again. Like, we're just too good to be that bad again. And Carolina probably plays the same way. Just Jersey will have to raise their level. Carolina is also totally slept on. Nobody talks about Carolina as having a chance to go deep in the playoffs. Nobody.
John?
They had 98 points or something. Darren, and I think everyone hates Darren the fact that the same stuff every year, right? Freddie Anderson has great numbers. He's going to be healthy in there in the biggest moments. Track record says you can't count on it. Will they be able to score in those biggest moments? Because they have Aho, great player, but not a superstar player. Svechnikov, I think, sort of has been slowed by some injuries. He hasn't sort of elevated to that game-changing individual guy. Nate just probably was their closest individual game changer. He doesn't play there anymore. Jarvis is a great player, but he's also not an individual guy. That's the question. When the system they use doesn't work, like when they play against a team that could defuse that system, who can play sort of without the system? Who can color outside the lines to create their offense? I don't know if they have that guy still, but God, they look good against Jersey game one. Anyways, I give them full credit. They look good that game.
For the record, Millard has been yapping about Carolina for 3 weeks. Oh. He's
just
been
think
saying
they've been ignored. And disrespected.
Except it's body of work. It's over the last 6 years. I mean, to Mike's point about they've played Rod's system for all that period of time, and they can't get over the hump. So this is sound and fury of the first round for the Carolina Hurricanes every year.
Part of it is the system, because during the regular season, you guys have been around teams, right? We get scouting reports, but we don't really pay that close attention all the time to scouting reports. They're not that in deep. Like, oh, they run a heavy 2-1-2 deep pinch down the wall, right? They step up in the neutral and they got a 1-3, whatever it is. And like, you process it. But like, I played last night. I'm trying to think about it in the morning. I got an app to do when I'm on the game. And it catches you more off guard. I think part of their struggle in the playoffs, John, is that this system, when you have a chance to feel it every game, you get a sense of like, hey, where do we find our little breaks, our space? How do we control it? More so during the regular season, where you don't have almost the bandwidth to process all that going into a game, a one-off against Carolina.
A Tuesday in November is different than a playoff series, more very for much. Carolina than anybody else in being very able much. To. But they won the Rantanen trade. I think that's great with Stankoven scoring a couple and Rantanen being quiet.
After one game, I mean,
it's hard to feel bad for Rantanen, John, but like, he's been through the ringer, don't you think? Like, I know he's got the $100 million contract, but like, emotionally, it feels like, I don't even know if he's settled yet. I don't know if he's sort of, you know, at peace with how everything has happened.
Do you think this is a tough series for him?
Brutally tough.
Yeah.
Brutally tough, because it's one thing to be traded away and be sort of angry and like, oh, I'm going to show them. That's not how he felt. He was just hurt. He was disappointed.
Yeah.
And he was very, and I admire him, he was very public about, I totally wanted to stay. I was desperate to stay. I can't believe I didn't get to stay. Like, it's not like I hate these guys. You're on, like, you're like, you wanted to be with them. So I think it's brutally tough for him.
Wait until the game's in Denver.
He had one late in the year, thank goodness, to get that out of the way. So, you know, he kind of got applause, a smattering of maybe some boos, a bit of a mixed bag. But I just, even for the best players, if you're not fully emotionally available and invested in what you're doing, it's hard to be the best version of yourself. And I just wonder if he has that emotional reservoir to draw on to be the best version of himself for Dallas. They need him to be. I just don't know if he's sort of, he didn't have it in Carolina, and he didn't really have it when he got to Dallas the first, you know, towards the end of the regular season. I don't know if he can find it for the playoffs.
Before we go, did you ever end up in the corner with Thomas Hurdle? Did you guys cross paths, Hurdle?
No, he's younger than I am. No, he's and that much goodness, younger. He's so big.
That's
he's
a compliment. He's too big. That's a compliment. Yeah.
Because I feel like Hurdle's been around forever, and you look great, Mike.
Well, I got a lot of filters on my camera. No, I watching the Golden Vegas play game one against Minnesota. Hurdle's had a good year, right? Quietly good, solid year, doing what he's supposed to do in behind Jack Eichel. Like, this is what he was acquired to be, just a good player behind a great one. But the way he sort of tied Brock Faber, one of the better defensive players in the league, in knots with his hands about this far apart on a stick. Like, he just went, put his stick down, and Faber couldn't move him. It's shockingly strong. I would not have liked that opponent one bit, because that would have worked well against me. I would have fallen trying to get that puck in house Faber.
And then turned around and went short side shelf. So he had physical.
Hang on. The short side shelf stuff. That's not a fancy shot anymore. Like, that's like literally every, like, we celebrated him. Like, look at the gap. It's off the guy's ear. Yeah. Honestly, there's not a player in the league, not one, who can't make that shot with like quasi regularity and see it all the time. Like, guys always are shooting up here. Like, I get it. The strength to win the battle and the skill to make the shot.
Yeah.
That's barely a skilled shot anymore. That is like a standard issue option for any player, not just the good ones. Your ears would be ringing. I would be shooting there all the time. Everyone shoots there all the time. It's not, we don't have to celebrate that much as like a super sneaky, great play. It's just, it's a play. Everyone does.
So last night in that game, we saw Ziv Bouin. I think it's Bouin. Mm-hmm. Is that how you pronounce it? Make his NHL debut.
Professional debut.
We saw Jimmy Snuggerud do it late in the season. You're a former college guy that jumped on board with the Maple Leafs late in a season. What's that like to walk into a room that has been together for so long? How difficult is that to do? And the juxtaposition of that is, what can be the attitude of the veterans to a kid coming in thinking that he's sliced bread?
It's a good question. So I walked into the Leafs, who were garbage. Like, we were out of the playoffs. So it was a
different. You were on a bad team, Mike. Were on a bad
different team. Different atmosphere altogether. So these guys are walking to playoff teams, guys who battled together to get there. Now, the one thing I find, and I was this way, so I'm guilty as charged. When you walk out of school, you probably have an irrational dose of confidence. Like, you think you're very good because you're coming from a level where you have been very good. Bouillon is not shy on confidence. Like, he believes he is very good. Snuggerud, same thing. Now, you know, like, on that Scheifele goal to Connor at the end of the game, you know, Snuggerud's out there, you know, as a weak side winger, you could probably sag to that lane. Like, you know, like, you get exposed a little bit on the finer details because you're not so dominant physically in the NHL as you would be, even for first round picks like Snuggerud and Bouillon. You're just not able to do as much stuff. So you got to do more little things. And I think that's what the coaches work on these guys with, like, details away from the puck, let them do their thing with it. And I think that is, like, man, Bouillon played what, 10 minutes last night? Like, not a lot in the game. You got to spot him in. You're on the road. It's a tight game. First game ever. What are you going to do? So that's the coach's job. The player's job is to, it doesn't take much, John. And this was my experience, and this is all it took. My first game, I was playing against Tampa in Tampa. This is 1997, so there's no internet. I don't know anybody on the team. I know Wendell Clark. I know Matt Sundin. Like, literally, Felix Boffin. Like, that's all I know. Like, I couldn't name Todd Warner and Freddie Modine and Steve Sullivan and Sergei Berezin. And, like, I didn't know these people. So I was so nervous and so out of my element that Larry Murphy, Hall of Famer Larry Murphy, who was at that point was probably 36 years old, had seen 1,000 players come and go out of a room, walked over to me before the game in a throwaway 20 seconds that he probably had done 1,000 times. Just said to me, "Hey kid," didn't even know my name. It's like, "Kid, whatever you did to get here, just do that and you'll be fine." And then he walked away, whatever. And that 15 seconds, I still get chills thinking about how it made me feel and the comfort that it gave me that I was going to be okay. And I think that's what a team introducing a new player out of school or out of Europe, Demidov or wherever it might be, that's what you try to give them, a little bit of confidence that it's going to be okay and that you're more than capable as you are to be successful here. However you deliver that message, whether it's over dinner or 10 seconds before a game, you give that to a guy, it's amazing. If you just empower them to play, how much better they'll be.
By the way, it's 13:27 he played. Including a minute and a half on the power play.
But that's where you want to put him.
Yeah.
Right? That was my question. Is it easier to put him there than put him 5-on-5?
Yeah. Because if he messes up, no worries. You're not going to get scored against. Don't worry about matchups. The only thing you worry about is the other guy's getting frustrated if he messes up. Like, hey, you got to be better than that if you're going to play here. But who is Minnesota's dynamic offensive defenseman? I don't really have one.
Well, Faber is the closest thing right now, right?
Right. So Faber's not Cale Makar. He's very good. I'm not saying he's not good, but he's not like a guy that, you know, he's out of this world good. You're pulling someone who can't. Like, how could you dare take him off and put this kid on? So,
yeah,
I mean, I think putting guys in position to be successful. Like, you're going to put Jimmy Snuggerud on your checking line? That's not a good idea. Like, that's you're better off putting a checker on there. So getting young guys in spots where they can make things happen that are comfortable to them is where they want to be.
I was actually mad that they put Jimmy Snuggerud in the shootout in Seattle. So,
get off my lawn. I don't know why he's all over
this.
Had
they won the game, they wouldn't have had to panic for that clinching game at home on the Tuesday. All they needed was that point, throw out the rookie.
Is the payoff worth it to put these guys in these situations that they haven't played in before?
Can be. I mean, Chris Kreider, I think when he stepped out of school.
Right.
You know, he's not a Hall of Famer. He's a good player, and he was awesome when he kept out. Now, Cale Makar is not fair because he's Cale Makar, so that's a different animal altogether. But you can get these guys coming out of pretty high level and being comfortable. And part of it, as you guys both know, is if you want to get them signed, you got to let them play. Yeah, right? If you want them to come out and turn pro and not burn a year or risk going back and going opting out after 4 years and going and leaving your team, you got to let them play. I was guaranteed time in the even I was guaranteed, Darren, time in the NHL when I turned pro. So it's part of the deal. When you go there, you're going to get to play.
Yeah. Johnny, you were good. I don't know why you're giving yourself.
No, it's all relative on that team.
Yeah. On that team, I was good. I played 18 minutes my first game.
I know.
What are you talking about?
Do you remember the promo? 13 Sundin, the great promo.
So, beyond the playoffs, Mike, you're always in tune. Peter Laviolette, no surprise, right?
No surprise there. It's amazing though, like how quickly it turns, almost unfairly. He won the President's Trophy. Great season for them last year. They don't play well this year. Guys underachieved. Now, part of the responsibility for Laviolette, well, one, he's got a track record of being great early and then having a relative short life on his success with the team. So has trailed him around for several clubs now, and it did once again. The other thing is that the Rangers were no good defensively. Like at times they looked lost or disinterested or whatever defensively, which can fall to the coach. Scoring goals, that's more often the players. But keeping them out of the net, when you got a goalie who's pretty good in Shesterkin, that is more often the coach, and they just couldn't quite get it. What's amazing though, John, is if you read the tea leaves, and you do all the time, how much Barkley Goodrow and Jacob Trouba's departures ruffled that room.
And the whole, like, how they managed Kreider all year too, right? I mean,
and I guess Kreider there too, to perhaps was he in or out or whatever it might be. But like, I get being friends with guys, and I get being disappointed or frustrated or angered by your club electing to trade your buddy Darren Millard. But like, you get, like, I've been on teams this happened, but you get over it. And it's amazing. They never really got over it, which is surprising.
No, it got them going last summer when they were dealing with the whole Trouba situation.
Goodrow as well, right? They basically forced him to waive, or else we're going to put you on waivers and you're going to go somewhere you don't want to go. Same thing they did for Trouba. You have a no trade. Well, either you let us trade you or we're going to put you on waivers and you can go to someplace you might not want to go. So I think at this point they almost need a new coach, but also they need like a cleansing. Like they got to go to the Aaron Roger Oshawa house or wherever he goes and like, you know, just let all the baggage go. Yeah. And like, are we in? Are we okay being here with the Rangers? Are we still angry at the team? Because if you're angry at the team, then you got to park that thing. Like, you can't sit on it for 2 years without. You wonder where the Rangers go. And I wonder where John, where does David Carl end up? Like, is it going to be Chicago? Everyone says it's going to be them. Philly would be interested. Like, where does David Carl and like, how I think
he
much?
Goes to a good team. He goes to a good team. He's got his, he can be patient.
He can pick his Rangers spot.
Yeah.
But you wonder, whatever.
Why not be with kids? Why not be with a good group of kids like Anaheim?
Right.
That's a possibility.
I would think he's going to get, the longest coaches maybe get a 5-year deal usually. He'll probably get longer than that because you're going to have to give him longer than that to get him out of school.
Yeah. You're going to
give him a $6 or $7 million a year contract to go coach
somebody,
the Ducks.
If somebody gives a guy who's never coached a game in the National Hockey League that kind of money and that kind of term, they should be looking for a job.
If it doesn't work out, they will be.
I don't dispute what a great coach he is. You've seen it firsthand. Mm-hmm. But that boy, we're starting to pay coaches like, you know, we're paying the potential of players. That's not normal in this league.
I thought you were going to say that you were going to try and start coaching
I'd be fun to watch. I wouldn't necessarily be any good, but I'd be fun to watch.
But in a league where the amount you can pay to players is finite and you're a wealthy team, the amount you can pay to coaches, whether they work for you or not, is infinite.
That's fair.
So if you don't care about the money, not my money to care about, but if you don't care about the Rangers, super wealthy club, an extra $3 million a year to the coach is a rounding error for that organization. So, you know, they have the ability to make that kind of decision. Whether it's wise or not, I don't know. But I also know if I'm Carl, I'm not leaving Denver for a 2-year plus an option. No. It's not going to happen. I already got rebuild. That great job. Yeah.
Patty Verbeek was cryptic to vague in his explanation
That's quite a span there, Darren. Cryptic to vague.
It is. And there was vagueness. And then there was like, I'm not going to say the real reasons, but it does sound like exit interviews played a real role in this decision.
So Dan Cronin, old school guy, hard nosed guy, and they played relatively well this year. Like, you know, McTavish took strides and Leo Carlson took strides and Cutter Gauthier was good. So they had success with it. But I think 2 years ago, like the end of the 24 season, there was a lot of noise in their post interviews. Like, oh, we don't know if we like exactly how he treats everyone and how he approaches day to day. And you wonder if that noise carried forward again and say, all right, two things. One, most coaches, we just talked about Carl, don't see rebuilds through to excellence. They rebuilds through to competitive. And then we go the next guy competitive to competing for a cup. And so that's probably not surprising that they're now at the point where like, now we're competing for playoffs. So thank you for your service to get us to here. We got someone else to take us to the next step.
Right.
And I think old school guy, new school players, top players are young guys who probably don't vibe with that energy long term. And you put all that in a basket, and now you got a pretty good opportunity there in Anaheim.
So Greg Cronin, I mean, I spent enough time with Greg when I was doing Oiler games that he would say, like, our veteran, we have no veteran leadership. And he was very frank about it. He was saying our veteran guys couldn't, they were happy living in Orange County. They had a great lifestyle, but they weren't winning. And to me, that was a real knock at a guy like Cam Fowler. That was a guy saying, so all of a sudden Fowler's out, Trouba's in. And we all know what a leader Trouba is. We all know what Trouba can bring to that situation. And so to me, and then you look at, as you talked about, I've looked at Roger Neilson twice with the Rangers and with Florida. And he got them to a certain point, but knew he couldn't, everybody knew he couldn't get them to the next step. And it was time to move on. Mm-hmm. And then they did. Guy Boucher in Tampa couldn't get them to the next step. Look, John Cooper came in, right time, right moment, changed the whole personality of the franchise. This is just the natural progression.
So why not say that instead of being
just because you're the general cryptic manager doesn't mean you're a great communicator. I love Pat. Pat Verbeek's a really – I mean, I've known Patty since he was 18 and playing. But that doesn't mean that, you know, that he's used to sitting in front of the media or anybody and trying to play the game, right?
Doesn't want to.
And we know he doesn't want to. I mean, right. He's right out of the Steve Yzerman playbook. Come on now.
Yeah, carbon copy. Yeah. I mean, you probably could have phrased it nicer and maybe leave it less to innuendo and speculation, but you know, and yet Cam Fowler, I don't know Cam Fowler. I don't go out west very often. He's been really good in St. Louis.
Hasn't he? Really good.
Been a difference maker, like a sneaky January trade, whatever that one went down. He's been good there. So, but that's an intriguing job. If I'm a top flight coaching prospect or a guy who's available for work, Anaheim intrigues me because they got some players, they got some pieces.
What's your plan for this? Plan for this week and the playoffs? Where are you going to be?
Around Toronto for a couple more days, in studio post Leaf game at TSN, then down to the network, NHL Network, for 4 or 5 days of post game stuff there. And then I got to get back and get ready to go to I'm going to Sweden. The World Championships are in Stockholm.
I better be going to Sweden. Go to Switzerland. Yeah.
So I'll be in Stockholm for a few weeks.
And then we get to see our pal inducted into the international.
Paul Graham, my longtime boss at TSN, one of the real pioneers, along with John Shannon, from the sort of same school. They grew up together in revolutionizing TV production and international play and its importance in Canada. Yeah, PG's going into the International Ice Hockey Hall of Fame under the broadcasting wing. Is that right?
Yeah, media broadcast. Yes. Yeah. I'm hoping to be there.
That means we'll have a red wine or two then with John in PG. In Stockholm. Yes, sir.
Really, Shanny? You're going over there?
I might.
I think you should.
Be nice if we could take the show on the road.
Here we come.
I maybe have heard of it.
Yeah.
enjoy the playoffs and safe travel. Stay ahead of PG for us.
All right, guys. Meanwhile, great to talk to you both.
I'm glad we got to the coaching conversation.
Yeah, me too.
Because the Greg Cronin situation just left me searching for answers where I'm not sure you needed to be searching. Now, if the reaction was the exit interviews, you can present that somehow. But I also had and have great respect for Greg Cronin and how he went in and laid down the law with a group that I think needed some structure.
No question. But at a certain point, the manager has to make the decision is, can this guy get us to the next level?
But all the optics were that they were happy with him, that they were fine with him up until the exit interviews.
I had heard late in the season that he was not going to be back.
Okay.
I think it's simplistic to think that you were relying on the player's thoughts before you make the decision. I think, listen, Pat Verbeek is a smart hockey guy. He is a very smart hockey guy, has a great sense. I think you can see that in the way he has built the roster in Anaheim and the improvement they have made. But there comes a time when you have to look and say to the coach, okay, we've got to expand the playbook. We've got to be better at this. Are you prepared to do that? You know, and in many ways, you know, Greg Cronin and John Tortorella are comparable in that what they want and how they get it out of people, what happens. And I like both guys. I'm a huge Torts fan. But, you know, the question becomes with the youth of this team, how does the coach get more out of them in 2025 with a new thought process on how to play the game?
I just wrote down my answer, but which job would you take if the dollars were the same, the Rangers or Anaheim?
Well, I think you should throw another team in there.
It's my question.
Oh. Okay, well, I'm going to answer your question, then I'm going to give you mine.
Okay. How do you change the question that
I
asked?
I just said I was going to answer your question. I would take the Ranger job.
I wrote down Anaheim.
I know you did because it's New York City. It's Madison Square Garden. It's the New York Rangers. Come on. It's under the greatest spotlight of all time.
So you're factoring in everything else other than the hockey club and the roster.
Yeah. Well, you're a coach. You're getting fired in 3 years. You better go and have a good time and enjoy it and be in the spotlight. So my question is, which is of the five teams that need coaches, Anaheim, Chicago, Rangers, Philly, Boston, which is the best job?
Best job would be New York because of the reasons that you said. I think the team that I would take would be Anaheim. And the club that I would be least enthusiastic about, Boston.
You see, and I love the Boston situation. Again, I think Boston's one of the great sports towns in the world.
Fine, but they just bottomed out.
I think there's stable ownership in Boston. I think that's a big factor. I think if you can start with Jeremy Swayman, Hampus Lindholm, Charlie McAvoy on your back end, I think you're in pretty good spot, and you can turn that team around quite quickly.
I don't mind the Philly job, and Chicago is still too far away.
Yeah, Chicago. You wonder about Chicago. I do wonder about Chicago. Chicago is too far away still, but that doesn't mean the people won't gravitate towards it.
As we say goodbye here for this episode, somebody put into AI and said, give me a picture of a National Hockey League brawl. Oh. Did you see this?
No.
And you know what AI spit out? A massive fight on the ice, and both teams were the Philadelphia Flyers from the 70s.
That's pretty good.
It was great.
So just as an aside on that kind of stuff, when we hear play-by-play guys now talk about brouhahas and skirmishes breaking out and fights everywhere, and they have no clue.
No.
They have no clue. I still remember doing bench-clearing brawls, Darren. Bench-clearing brawls in the 80s and having a plan of attack.
On the TV side?
On the TV side. Oh, yeah. Because this is long before there was a lot more video available. So the moment a player and two players on opposite teams dropped their gloves. So one fight started. Every camera had an assignment. So one camera was assigned to do both benches at the same time. So you could decide which player came off the bench first.
Oh, you were trying to bust guys.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Sure.
You meanie.
Just telling the story.
I want a line brawl in these playoffs. That might get me going.
Well, you got your fill. You got your fill with the three brawls in 9 seconds at the Four Nations.
Yeah. We'll chat with you on Wednesday. Looking forward to it as we continue to cover the Stanley Cup playoffs.
Will the Tampa series have started by then?
Not sure. Imagine the information overload that's happening with those guys.
Just tell Cooper to take the day off.
We'll chat with you next time on 100% Hockey with him and me.
You want to fight?
Yes.